And good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to The Other Side of Midnight. It's our final edition for the week. It's been a really amazing week. Iowa, next week we have New Hampshire, and some other things to cover. Next week, which is the Open Hailing Frequencies night, is the show right after the evening in New Hampshire with the election of the Republicans and the Democrats and this incredible revolution, as Bernie Sanders is calling it, because, you know, that's kind of what it is. Before we start the actual show, I want to do something at the top that is important. You'll notice if you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on Radio with Pictures, item number one is Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut who walked on the moon, died at the age of 85. I met Mitchell right after he returned from the moon. I met him with a Russian poet at Cape Canaveral, and it was absolutely extraordinary. Mitchell was different. Mitchell was an engineer, but he was kind of an engineer who really was an artist in hiding, I guess, because as you may or may not know, one of the things that he did en route to the moon that he didn't tell anybody he was going to do en route to the moon is he did a Reinhart experiment with folks, I believe, at Duke University, you know, the classic ESP, telepathy, you know, mind over matter kind of thing. And apparently his score when he got back, after he did the test somewhere between Earth and Moon, I don't know whether, I think it was only on the way back. I think on the way out they were too focused on the issues of, landing safely and getting home. But on the way home, he did this Reinhart experiment at various times, and apparently they had arranged it so that they would be synchronistically looking at the clocks simultaneously, because relativity doesn't really enter into it here, because we're moving at relatively slow speeds and within the Earth-Moon system. So apparently his results, Mitchell's ESP results, were significantly above chance. I had hoped tonight that we would have a friend of ours be able to join us to talk about Edgar Mitchell's contribution to the ET UFO field, because he's the only astronaut, really, maybe except for Gordon Cooper, who is no longer with us, and now Edgar is not either, but he's the only astronaut that really made a major claim to knowledge of UFO activities, ET activities, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll probably do that on next week, probably on Wednesday morning, Open Hailing Frequencies, because I really don't want to take a lot of time away from guests, because we only have 2 hours, and 2 hours goes by really quickly when you have an exciting guest. So let me get to what we're going to talk about this morning, because this is pretty amazing. I've been wanting to do this for a very, very, very long time. So let me start this out in the way that we're all supposed to do this. Randall Carlson is a third-generation professional builder and co-owner of Archetype Design / Build, Inc. His interest in architecture and building led to an in-depth study of the methods, symbolism, sacred geometry, and science incorporated in sacred structures throughout the ages. This is going to be so much fun, because I don't think he knows what we measured in some of these ancient sacred places. Anyway, Randall was initiated into the Masonic craft in 1978 and has been an active Freemason since that time, rising to become master of one of the oldest and largest lodges in Georgia. He endeavors to bridge the gap between archaic systems of knowledge and modern science. Over the years, he has studied with a wide variety of teachers, including astronomers, geologists, historians, Himalayan swamis, Brahmin priests, Sufi masters, archaeologists, geometricians, and architects. His work is a synthesis of these traditions, and he has taught classes and delivered lectures to thousands of people all over this continent for over 35 years. He's also presented several hundred workshops in sacred geometry and is at present developing an online course. I could go on, but since we haven't really seen each other, I think, for 14 or 15 years, Randall, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Well, it's great to be here, Richard, and it's great to hear your voice.
Well, likewise. Now, do you want to tell folks how we met? Because that was such a seminal milestone in this investigation, in our Enterprise mission investigation, into the possibility of ancient cultures and architecture in the solar system, as well as ancient cultures and architecture here on Earth from high-tech societies that have long since vanished, that I think we had come to Atlanta that morning to speak at a conference, and we were staying at a bed and breakfast, and you showed up. And what
happened? I showed up. I don't remember how I just stumbled in there, but there you were.
Oh, come on. For 14 years, I've been wondering, how did Ren, you know, it's one of those Casablanca questions. Of all the gin joints in all the world, he stumbled into my bed and breakfast, delivering an extraordinary gift, Randall. Do you remember what you brought me to see?
Of course I do, Richard. Well, of course I do.
Tell them what it was and tell them why it is really, really important.
Oh, boy. The Viewmaster reel from the very early 1950s. I think it was actually even 1951.
Yep.
Yeah, 51, I believe. And it was based upon, I think, probably the first sci-fi show on television, if I'm not mistaken, the Tom Corbett Space Cadet.
Yep, Saturday morning serial.
Saturday morning serial, yeah. See, now I was just a little bit too young to have caught the original. It was, you know, because that was the same year I was born, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I had that, I got that reel set for my fifth birthday. I actually do remember opening the box, and here's this reel set, and here's that, and several others, you know, dinosaurs and things that totally infatuated me for at least several years. But, I hung on to that because the story was so intriguing. And it was a story about these space cadets that journeyed to Mars and found the evidence of a lost civilization. And the really intriguing thing about it was, is by that time, I had become very familiar with your work. I think I had worked my way through Monuments on Mars actually a couple of times,
mm-hmm.
and had sat down, and plotted out a lot of the geometry, trying to, you know, duplicate some of your geometry, trying to discover if there were new relationships among some of those features in Cydonia, and had been going through that whole scenario in my mind. And then somewhere at some point, I just realized, well, I've seen all this before. Why is all this so familiar to me? And then I thought about it, and I went, and I had a box that was probably the only thing that I had retained from my youth, from all those decades ago. The only thing, and it had a few little stray items in it. I think my brother
I think we met in 1992 there in Atlanta. So this must have been a cigar box with these Viewmaster slides that was decades old.
That is the picture. It was a cigar box with these Viewmaster slides in it that were decades old.
Well, I see. What was so funny is this big guy. I mean, Randall is a big guy. You know, as a builder, you got to be a big guy. And he comes in, and we have a whole bunch of people sitting around this, you know, board and breakfast table. We're just having breakfast. And he comes in, and he sits this cigar box in front of me at this dining room table with tablecloths and napkins and orange. I mean, it was a beautiful Southern hospitality spread for people who were going to be speaking at the conference. And I'm wondering how this guy got in. And then I opened the cigar box, and I remember taking out the envelope, the little Viewmaster envelope, and I think you had a Viewmaster with you.
I'm pretty sure I did, yeah.
Because otherwise I would have had to hold up the light and magnifying. So I put on the reel, and I start going through, because my grandfather bought in the classic 1950s tradition one of those Viewmaster stereo slide cameras, which was a camera that basically had two lenses, and when you took a picture of the Grand Canyon or your kids, this is before selfies, of course, it would come out in stereo, and they would print it in these Viewmaster reels that you put in this little plastic viewer with, looked like a kind of a very modern version of a pair of squarish binoculars. And then you would rotate this little handle on the upper right-hand side with your index finger, and then the Viewmaster would rotate, and you'd see with both eyes a stereo view that the camera had taken. And that's how I got into all this. And then, so when you set that Viewmaster box in front of me, on that breakfast table that morning, Randall, it was like, oh my God, because it was such a trigger to my own childhood and my grandfather, because they drove all over the country, and of course we always had to go to Grandma and Grandpa's house to look at their slides of their latest trip. So we got a lot of looking at ViewMaster slides. So I'm opening this box, and I reach in, and I pick this thing up, and I'm looking at it, and I suddenly realize what it is you have brought me, because I don't know whether even you understood the incredible significance, the paradigm-shattering significance of that ViewMaster reel.
Well, I had a pretty good idea. I have to confess, I had a pretty good idea. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made it my mission for that day to get down there and find you and put that into your hands.
Well, do you remember that if you start with frame number one, it opens up with the opening. It's the cadets, and it was kind of a quasi-military organization. The spaceship was called Polaris. It was kind of, a pointed spaceship with fins, and it would land like Elon Musk's rockets are now landing. And this, of course, is 51. And it's all in color. And it turned out that the ViewMaster, did you know the ViewMaster was a pilot for the first script of Tom Corbett before it went on television?
No, I did not realize that.
Yeah.
I didn't. No, until just this moment. Now, I didn't realize that was the pilot.
And it was written in part by a very, very famous German space science writer, Willy Ley, who came to the United States to escape Hitler and the Germans and the war and all that. And then he only reconnected with von Braun after the war, when von Braun came over leading, his merry band of men to help the United States develop their own rocket program. But this ViewMaster slide was after the war. It was 1950-51. And Willy Ley was one of the script writers. And what it was, Randall, I mean, the details are what's so exquisite. So let me go through a couple of details and see if it rings a bell.
Oh, please do.
They start out in the Mission Control Center of whoever Tom Corbett and his guys worked for. This quasi-military kind of Air Force organization that had cadets and, ran space missions. And basically, it was kind of Boy Scouts in space.
Right.
And the first scene is the commandant of the academy where these student cadets are studying has a table, and on the table there's something floating, and it looks like a little tetrahedron, and it is. And then when you go through and he's obviously talking, and the next scene show the cadets in the Polaris standing on the moon on its tail fins. Typical Chesley Bonstell, ragged scenery, gorgeous lunar 1950s extrapolation, all of which is wrong, but it looked really cool. And the guys in their multicolored spacesuits, which came from Robert Heinlein and Destination Moon, the various spacesuit colors would be color-coded. So if you saw a color of a spacesuit, that was, Cadet Corbett, or that was Stanley something or whatever. And they're all standing around on the moon in this second frame of this ViewMaster slide looking at a glass tetrahedron about the size of two full-grown men, maybe 12 feet high, and there's a globe of Mars inside it with all the sides touching the planar faces of the tetrahedron at the points on the tetrahedron where a circumscribed sphere inside a tetrahedron, not a tetrahedron in a sphere, but a sphere in a tetrahedron, which is the reverse equation of this, physics model. And on this globe of Mars, remember, there was a place marked where they were supposed to land? And the whole thing was a time capsule on the moon that then led them to Mars, where they dug in the sands, because, of course, in that era, Mars had a breathable atmosphere. And you see these cadets, digging with shovels in sand. And they're digging in a bunch of ancient ruins. And next to one of the guys wielding a shovel is a statue combining a man and a lion. Does that sound a tad familiar?
Yes, it does.
So that leads them. So they go down into the ruins. They finally get into the ruins on Mars.
Yeah.
And they find a chamber with controls and all that and some kind of a view screen. And up on the view screen pops an image and a recording of an ancient lost civilization which died eons ago and was located in the asteroid belt. And they go in the spaceship Polaris to the asteroid belt. You see all this in the various frames as you click through the ViewMaster. And the final scenes are they're inside one of the asteroids, and inside there is a catacomb, an archive, some kind of a mausoleum or something. And there's more view screens showing that the beings from the asteroid belt who lived on the planet, which was in the asteroid belt and was now destroyed and had colonized Mars, were in fact big, furry, cat-like beings, just like the right-hand side of the feline aspect of the face on Mars.
Well, that's what struck me.
And you just brought this as a gift, you know, like one of the three magi. And you laid it in front of me on that breakfast table. So, to make a long story short, we took the ViewMaster reel back to New York. We took it to a major lab. We had huge enlargements made, and then we made individual slides for, you know, presentations from those ViewMaster slides. And it's an astonishing piece of work because, again, like Jack Kirby predicting in 1958 that there was a face on Mars in a comic book from 58, decades before Viking would show us a face on Mars, this ViewMaster reel, authored in part by Willie Ley, science advisor to, among other things, later Wernher von Braun, was depicting an ancient civilization not only on Mars, but in the asteroid belt across the whole solar system, which was extinct, its planet in rubble, and the aliens, or the ETs, turned out to be big, furry, cat-like beings. What do you think we can bet on that maybe when we ultimately find out the answer to this mystery, the ETs that we're going to find out there, in fact, might bear a little resemblance to what we see on this amazing ViewMaster slide?
And one detail was that the original tetrahedron that we see in the first scene was the capstone to the tetrahedron on the moon.
Yes.
And it was the placing of the tetrahedral capstone onto the truncated pyramid on the moon that activated it and made its walls transparent so that you could now see the 3D hologram of Mars suspended inside the tetrahedron.
Yep. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So, let's now stop there and give people a kind of a window into how you got into all this stuff. Because if you're a third generation builder, mason, architect, construction expert, et cetera, and your family has been in the building business for a lot of years, how did you wind up wondering about ancient buildings, not only on this planet, but like on Mars? In other words, what led you to breakfast that morning? How did you wind up at my table in all the gin joints in all the world giving... By the way, you know, Randall, I did not use that incredible piece of data for 8 years. It wasn't time.
I knew
time.
It was a while.
It was
I knew it had, some time had transpired, yeah.
It was 8 years until we had assembled enough additional evidence that that model on that ViewMaster, in fact, can hold its own.
Well, and you know why this is so satisfying to me is because I don't know if the originals that I have here, maybe you ran across other copies. Are there other copies out there? I don't know. I haven't seen any.
I haven't either.
I mean, this may be the only copy in existence. So the fact that you did that and now they're archived,
yes,
and they're preserved is, to me, very satisfying.
I know exactly. And we made huge Cibachrome print enlargements.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see these things from across the room, and it's
wow,
astonishing. The artwork is excellent. The imagery of, you know, an ancient Mars, civilizations and all that. But the really cool part is the anti-gravity part, the amazing physics part, and the fact that these aliens were feline. And that's the entire storyline we've figured out over the last 35 years.
Yeah, that was the truly astonishing thing to me because... Like I said, I had this thing ingrained in my consciousness because I used to what I used to do, Richard, was I sometimes would fake being sick, like first, second grade, you know, third grade, stay home so I could get in my room, close the door, adjust the curtains so the light was just right, and sit there and go through my ViewMaster slides and literally immerse myself into that world.
Mm.
Because, you know, what do kids have in the 1950s to now? I mean, you know, the kids now, you know, can immerse themselves in these unbelievable things that we didn't have. But what I had was that ViewMaster, and it was like a way for me to transport myself to another world. And along with that Tom Corbett, I had the, you remember the 3D animated movie Animal World that had the animatronic dinosaurs done by Ray Harryhausen?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that was another one of the famous sets of reels that came with it. And, you know, that was interesting because the whole thing ends with a huge cataclysm. The sky is on fire. It turns red. And I think the Animal World was probably 19. It had to have been before I got the ViewMaster. So it would have been 54, 55 when that movie came out. And it depicts the catastrophic end of the late Cretaceous and doesn't really get specific about an asteroid impact. But what it does convey with the sky on fire and the land splitting open and everything, all the details are, in effect, there. And I can say that those two things really inspired me from that age on. Now, how I got from there to you with breakfast that morning.
Yep.
Well, you know, the thing was, I think, is that, you know, when I got old enough to, you know, basically have to earn a living, I had learned enough carpentry from my dad that I began working as a carpenter. And, you know, we had started helping him actually build vacation cabins in the woods of northern Minnesota back in about 1965 or 66. And the next 3 or 4 years on our summers and so on, I would work with my dad, helping my dad build various things. And by the time I got out of high school, I took a couple of years off and just traveled around the country and was basically a bum that a lot of people were in the late 60s. But what happened was that I got really interested. I went through a lot of the same, you know, processes that a lot of people did back then. And I ended up being part of this group that was studying yoga under this Himalayan Swami. And one summer, I think it was in summer of 1971, the group that I was a part of wanted to build a couple of domes for him to come and stay in up there in northern Minnesota. And since myself and my brothers had been the most experienced carpenters in the group, we kind of got drafted to be sort of lead the building process. And one of them was a 3/8 typical Buckminster Fuller, you know, geodesic dome. But the other one was a little more interesting. It was actually a 5/8 dome, so it flared out from the base, and then it came up and it tapered to a spire. And so in order to figure out how to build that thing that one of the architects in the group had actually designed, I had to really immerse myself into, you know, Buckminster Fuller's geometry and trying to figure out, you know, how this, basically how to lay this out and how to cut the pieces and what angles and all the geometry.
Yeah, because Bucky Fuller was all the rage back then with the Dymaxion and the domes and all that stuff. Yeah, okay.
Yes, he was. But what the architect in our group did had taken in the basic idea of the dome, but he had modified it to duplicate. He used the geodesic geometry, but he modified it to mimic an Islamic, the dome of like an Islamic mosque almost. So the thing actually came up to a point at the top, and so it was a very interesting and challenging project to build, and so it was interesting enough that there was a large format, almost magazine-like book that came out called Shelter. I don't know if you remember yet, but it was quite a big seller there in about 1973, I think. And it was basically a compilation.
Oh, wasn't there a guy in San Francisco? Oh, what's his name? He was involved in the Whole Earth Catalog.
Yeah, Stuart Brand.
Stuart Brand, yeah. Wasn't he involved in this book, Shelter?
Well, he might have been. That would seem right up his alley.
Because it seems to me that I read his name associated with this stuff because they had things like bale houses and Coke bottle houses and all kinds of environmental hacks that you could do really cheaply to make really good homes.
Well, yeah, and it had everything. It had a cross-section. It was a very broad cross-section of vernacular architecture, experimental architecture, and everything in between. They were looking at, bamboo houses, in Indonesia, and they were looking at, like you said, bale houses and wooden churches up in, Scandinavia. Just the whole cross-section. But they had one of the pages was dedicated to this particular dome that we built. This 5/8 dome. So it appeared prominently in this book shelter that was quite widely sold. I couldn't tell, probably about millions, but it was certainly around. It was popular enough that they did a reprinting of it, 6 or 8 years ago. So my original copy had pretty much completely fallen apart. But in any case...
well used.
As these things do. So because of the fact that this dome that me and my two younger brothers and some of these other people had worked on and built was in this book, I, of course, had to procure the book. Well, in that, they had a number of things. Like one was having to do with the geometry of Islamic mosques and the geometry of calligraphy and the geometry of, some of these rug weavings and how esoteric knowledge was encoded geometrically and then woven into these rugs. Then they had a section on some of the geometry of the cathedral builders, and that particularly fascinated me. I just had always, for some reason, loved geometry. Even as a kid, I loved geometry, and so I was quite drawn to that at that point to start studying. They had in the discussion of some of the, I don't recall if it was actually in the connection with the cathedral building geometry, but it was basically a dissertation on the golden section and its applications in architecture. What the golden section is.
Mm-hmm. 1.618, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, et cetera. It's exactly. It's an arithmetical geometric series, but it's also, a geometric form, a pattern. It's found, in the Pentagon, the pentagram relationships. It's found, in human anatomy and all throughout nature, but so it had.
It's one of those natural geometric constants like pi that never closes. It goes on and 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 on. Do you remember that Carl Sagan wrote a book? I think it was Contact, where he actually had pi have codes in it past the several million decimal points, recurring messages and all that left by somebody, which means somebody.
I went ahead and memorized it I stopped at a million places, though. No, not really. But I don't remember the book. I remember vaguely. Yes, I do remember vaguely that.
Okay, so you're looking at these amazing, natural constants, and you're thinking...
Yeah, well, that led me into this, what's going on here, and realizing that, this was, in effect, a kind of a language or a code that was being employed by these people. And, so it led me to, from one thing leads to another. Of course, once I started immersing myself in trying to understand the Middle Ages and this amazing geometry that they were employing to design these cathedrals and how they would integrate these forms, this naturally led me to the Masonic Order. And then I looked into that enough to find out to become convinced that, unbeknownst to a lot of the brothers who are involved, they were sitting on quite a treasure trove of archaic symbolism.
Fascinating. Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Randall Carlson. We're going to try to now look back thousands and thousands of years back to other civilizations, other cultures, and follow Randall's trail as he takes this interest in geometry, this remarkable science that shouldn't exist at a time when it exists and was exemplified all over Europe in those amazing cathedrals. We'll get more into the details when The Other Side of Midnight comes back. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and yes, we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight this morning. It's a little frosty here. It's about 21 degrees in the Land of Enchantment. It's probably a little warmer there, Randall, right?
I think it's about 28 or 29 degrees tonight is the low.
Don't get a sunburn now. Come on. Anyway, so...
It's nice and vigorous during the day. You know, if you're going to be outside working at all, it's for me, ideal weather for that.
So as part of this search, you realize that there was a lot more even to Masonic traditions than you'd thought before.
Yes, I sort of, you know, came to that, you know, through, you know, once if you read widely, you know, into these kind of things, you constantly come across references to certain consistent themes, and Freemasonry was one of those that just kept coming up, you know, in my reading and trying to find out more about geometry and the how they built things back in the day, because I was just fascinated by that. So I think I finally actually came, just met a couple of Masons about 75 or 76, and got to know them, and finally just in 78 I requested a petition, which is how you do it, because Masons don't solicit. You have to make the initial... the initial move, it's the candidate has to initiate the process.
You mean the candidate has to ask the right question?
Yes, exactly. So even though I was, I went into this lodge of, you know, very distinguished Freemasons back then, I was at that point the youngest brother in the lodge, you know, and I had hair, you know, half a foot past my shoulders, and I'm in there with these, you know, retired admirals and you know, very distinguished old gentlemen, but they accepted me right in, and, you know, which was great, and I got to hang out with these guys, and had I, you know, not joined when I was 27 years old, I wouldn't have gotten to know these guys socially, you know, that were, you know, at that point in their 60s, 70s, even some of them in their 80s. And it turned out that, you know, most of them were not too knowledgeable, but there was a handful of them that were extremely knowledgeable. And a couple of them, one was a retired architect, Wilfred Gregson, who had actually designed the temple building, the large temple building that's here in Atlanta, and a number of other buildings, and he had encoded some Masonic geometry in there. So he was still alive back then, and he would give a monthly class in the temple building. They have a library there, and he would give a class. So for about a year or more, I would go every month to his class, and he would impart his studies of the symbolism of Freemasonry, the astronomy of it, the geometry of it, and so on. And so that's pretty much, you know, my introduction to the craft. And I was led to it by virtue of my interest, basically, in ancient architecture. And, you know, that geometry, and I've, of course, have found out that, you know, and it's taken some time to really understand some of these very complex symbol compositions that they have in the lodges. They'll have Masonic carpets, for example, that will be rolled out, and it'll be a series of anywhere from a dozen up to maybe even two dozen images arrayed in a certain way. And after you think about those, study the various meanings of these symbols, and you study how they're related to each other and laid out on these teaching carpets, and you realize that it's essentially an alphabet. It's a symbolic alphabet, and you essentially it's relating a story, a whole story. And this story is not only encoded in the symbolism and the layout of the lodge itself, it's also encoded in the ritual of the degrees, and basically all of the higher degrees are just extrapolations of the three fundamental degrees, the apprenticeship degree, the craftsman degree, and the master's degree, which are the first three. And then all of the higher degrees are basically just elaborations on the symbolism that's presented in those three degrees. But, you know, you find out, you learn in the course of of the work itself that, hey, if you want to understand what all of this means, you've got to study some things. You've got to study geometry. You've got to study astronomy. You've got to study music. You've got to study rhetoric. When you put these things together, then you can begin to actually decipher what this symbolism is saying. So now, I didn't come to this immediately. It took me a while to to dwell on these things. But, you know, now at this stage, you know, I've got enough interest and background in astronomy and geology and all of these other subjects and geometry that I have, you know, been able to, in effect, I think, decipher part of this this corpus of symbolism that's been handed down. And, you know, it goes back, certainly, much earlier than the lodges of craft builders in the Middle Ages, because they inherited the, you know, they inherited, it was passed down most likely through the Comachene builders. You know, during those Dark Age periods, they inherited it from the groups like the Roman Collegium, who inherited it from the Dionysian artificers. And there are these various groups that were custodians of these various traditions of geometry and astronomy and how that was related to the architecture. And so the architecture.
So Randall, are you kind of bypassing or ignoring the Templars coming back from the Crusades to Europe, and suddenly this incredible era of mega cathedrals erupts in the landscape? I mean, I've always thought, based on that connection and the weirdness of the whole, you know, the Pope who set them into the Middle East to reclaim Jerusalem in, you know, 195 and all of that, I've always thought that the Templars basically found ancient knowledge, ancient architecture, ancient engineering, ancient whatever, and they used it to make themselves incredibly wealthy, to basically become indispensable to the Middle Eastern society, to transform certain cultural things, like they're the ones that instituted international banking for the first time.
Right.
And I thought they may have had secret architectural knowledge that was encoded and used to build these amazing buildings, and that's how we got this window on a much more ancient and extraordinary architecture than we'd ever had before.
Well, think about this. Okay, so the original nine, they go to Jerusalem in the year 1118. They present themselves to King Baldwin, who puts them up in a wing of his castle. It's right adjacent to the ruins of King Solomon's temple. He gets called off to one of the Crusades, leaves there, and abandons these nine guys for, what, next 9 years? Ten years?
Yes.
And what do they do? They're supposed to be there, supposedly policing the highways to protect the pilgrims.
Saving
what are they
pilgrims.
Really doing? They're down in the subterranean regions of these ruins, performing what could have been history's first archaeological dig. And yes, I think you could be absolutely right. They could have returned to France with something in their possession. They returned in 1128. Is it any coincidence that the first Gothic cathedral at St. Denis was now underway 2 years later?
Exactly. Randall, you're reading my mind, because look at what's arrayed in those cathedrals. Not only, you know, flying buttresses and cantilever forces and all these extraordinary engineering and architectural details, but the symbolism.
Yes, the symbolism. That's the kicker. It's, well, like has been said by Victor Hugo, you know, these cathedrals are textbooks in stone.
Yep.
They literally are textbooks in stone. And when you begin to, and see, that's one of the things about Freemasonry, is it provides one of the keys to deciphering this corpus of symbolism that's come down.
But so you said that most of the guys you talked to, the keys were long since dead. They didn't even realize they had the keys.
No, exactly. That's the majority of them, which is fine, because, see, this is the way the system is designed to work. It's multidimensional, so there will be more than one reason why individuals will enter the craft. And some of the reasons, basically, there are men in there who are there only for the reason because they can do charitable works. And there are guys who just spend, you know, volunteer many, many hours putting on Masonic functions that raises money that goes to all of these various causes that Freemasons support, you know, the hospital for crippled and burned children, cancer wards for kids, eye hospitals, mostly oriented towards children who are in need. So there are brothers in there who are there really for that reason solely. And they're not that interested in the deeper technical aspects of the craft, you see. But there are other brothers that are. But the point is that the way the system is designed, for whatever reason, you're there, whatever your motive is there, part of being there and staying there is learning the ritual, learning the symbolism, and passing it on. So, you know, just think of it, you know, you might have a group of people who can't even read, but they're preserving a book, and then eventually it reaches somebody who's literate and can open the book and actually read the text.
So are you saying, and again, obviously you're going to only speak from your own perspective, but do you think that that Freemasonry exists in part not to build Shriner hospitals and not to help kids with cerebral palsy and not to, you know, send urban kids to youth camps in the country so they can, you know, but exists in fact in part to preserve ancient information? And because most of the membership doesn't even know that, that's another layer of the protection around the ancient information that needs to be preserved.
Oh, I could certainly accept that, yes, that is the case. That, you know, my own studies have convinced me that, yeah, there's this tremendous body of symbolical information there, just massive body of information encoded in this symbolism. And yes, it's being preserved and passed on for presumably some reason at some point. You know, the whole idea is that you know, you have philosophical or speculative masonry, but then you've got operative masonry. And for the last three
and
to
wait,
five
wait, wait,
years,
what's the difference between the two?
Well, speculative Freemasonry is basically what we have today. They don't actually build cathedrals or build temples. But operative Masons do. Now, when
you mean like,
when,
like you and your family?
Yeah, but of course we were building things, but we weren't building things as Masons. My dad wasn't a Mason. My grandfather on my mother's side was, and he didn't tell me actually until after I became one. Several years after I became one, I was down visiting him, and I had never even known. Never even known. And then he goes and pulls out his old Masonic apron, which I still have and wear to lodge sometimes. But in any case, operative Masonry essentially phased out over several centuries, beginning in about the early 14th century. You know, the whole wave of high Gothic building lasted about a century and a half. And then it essentially just evaporated. I mean, in some cases, there's, I think it's Bouguer or I'm forgetting which one, you know, they've talked about, you know, how they've walked in and there was almost just like tools left behind, like almost like the workman left for lunch and never came back, you know.
Interesting. What's the contemporary academic theory for why the cathedral building suddenly stopped?
Well, I don't think that there is any real, you know, there might be in some of the obscure and scholarly works that I have not yet accessed. I have my own theory.
Oh, by all means, tell us.
Well, you see, what happened was, I think it's no coincidence that, you know, during the cathedral building era, that was, you know, what paleoclimatologists would call the medieval warm period.
Okay.
It came on the heels of the Dark Ages. And, you know, the Dark Ages basically decimated the population of Europe and left them, you know, in a sorry state for about three or four centuries.
But that was because of the plague.
Well, the plague, you see, the shift in the climate preceded the plague.
Oh.
You can see the shift in the climate began around 530, early 530s. The plague came along in 542, Justinian plague, and it came on the heels of the famine that had been brought on by the agricultural collapses, that had been brought on by this shift of the planetary climate from essentially what had been the Roman warmth into this polar, this darkness that lasted for about a decade. Dendrochronologists, Mark Bailey, has done exhaustive studies on tree rings from that era and has been able to build a very solid case that over most of the Northern Hemisphere, for almost a decade, forest growth came to a halt.
I seem to remember, Randall, in some obscure paper I saw somewhere relatively recently, that there are people, geologists, whatever, who think that climate incursion may have been affected by either a cometary or asteroid impact of moderate size that basically dumped a whole bunch of stuff in the stratosphere and created global cooling, very similar to what happened with the eruption of Krakatoa centuries later.
Yeah, exactly. But it really even more on more of an extreme scale.
Oh, yes.
And it seemed like that this episode of this this shift lasted literally for centuries. And when the warmth basically came back, you know, one of the things that happened there was the sea ice that had extended down south during the course of the Dark Ages extended back well up past Iceland. And that was what allowed that first incursion of the Vikings to sail out. It was because a century earlier they would not have been able to actually make that voyage because of the sea ice was had basically cut off that, those northern routes. So with the coming back of the warmth, the sea ice receded, some of the first exploration came out. We began to see, you know, the pinnacle of the Islamic empire, the Islamic traditions there in the Mesopotamian area. And then in Europe, we have a whole series of agricultural surpluses. If you study, like, population dynamics, you discover that population began to increase dramatically. Infant mortality decreased, life extension by a decade or more on average. And in fact, there have been anatomical studies that have shown that during that period, the stature of Europeans increased on an average of about 4 inches.
Hmm.
So it was really a time of basic prosperity. And because of the surpluses that were created, it created the wealth provided the means, because obviously the building of these cathedrals was an enormous social undertaking.
And multi-generational, like 30 years.
And multi-generational. And these craftsmen who were, these tens of thousands of craftsmen being employed on this project, all had to be housed and fed and clothed. And so that meant that there had to be an entire social infrastructure in place to support these tens of thousands of craftsmen working. And
so, Randall,
really,
Randall, hang on. Yeah. I just had a thought. You know, and I do that to everybody because if I don't enunciate the thought when I have it, given everything else with this show, it will go away and no one will ever hear what the thought is. And here's the thought. Oh, come on, thought. Come back. Is it not possible that the Templars, after they'd found amazing stuff under Jerusalem, realizing how amazing it was and how it was for the ages, not just for them, they created a mechanism in stone to preserve and move that information into the future, centuries, 1,000 years, by building in an imperishable material and building the symbology inside?
I totally think that they were building for the future.
Excellent. Okay.
I do. We would be in complete agreement on that. And you know, it's important to bear in mind that, you know, somebody, and probably one of the key players was this Bernard of Clairvaux.
Oh, yes.
He was one of the prime movers behind that Templar mission. And we don't know who he was working with or what their motives were, but clearly I think that there were somebody operating behind the scenes. Because while in order for that first Gothic cathedral to get underway, two years after their return, the craftsmen already had to have been assembled and trained. The materials already had to be in hand. You see? So somebody is back on the home front getting things organized so that it's ready when these guys return.
Now that's an interesting insight. Very interesting.
Well, it had to. I mean, there's no way that they could have found the number of craftsmen needed, get them trained, get the materials in hand, get the stone cut. You know, you don't see that the carpentry work that goes into it, because the carpentry work is all in the formwork. But there's extensive, very complex carpentry work, because you form all, like the ogival vault is actually formed in timber before the stone is laid up, you see. So you've got this whole substructure of this elaborate timber and carpentry work that once the stonework is done and in place, it becomes self-supporting and the formwork is then removed. But so you had to have carpenters and stonemasons. You had to have glaziers and people that could create these incredible stained glass windows. You had to have astronomers there, because all of the cathedrals all are laid out according to certain astronomical alignments.
Interesting.
Every one of them, every one that I've looked at anyway, has some significant astronomical alignment in it. And there's also apparent sophisticated knowledge of geography encoded in here, because every cathedral had its own standard of measurement, its own modulus. And that modulus was adjusted according to its latitude, it's distance from the equator. And so it's some very sophisticated stuff going on in these cathedrals. And so somebody had to, you know, somebody sent these first nine knights out. You know, somebody was behind the scenes organizing these people, getting all the materials in place. Because, you know, as a builder, I know how much work precedes actual groundbreaking. You know, when you actually bring the crew out and start to work on a project, there's a whole lot of stuff that precedes that, you see.
Of course.
And building something as complex as a cathedral, you know, yeah. So it seemed like there was a final piece.
So anyway, how we backed into this was you were talking about how this went on for about 100 years and then it stopped. You mean the Templars and their associates who took on this mission, they basically finished their effort to immortalize information in stone as time capsules, that they only needed X number of cathedrals to complete their mission?
Well, I think what they did was they got as much done as they could within the window of opportunity that they had. Because what you see is that the decline in the cathedral building happens within a decade or two of...
Wait a minute, we kind of lost you on Skype there.
Yeah.
You might want to repeat that.
Okay, I said the window of opportunity they had basically closed within a decade or two of the next major climate shift, which basically brought on the first phase of what we know of as the Little Ice Age. And between around 1320 of bad agricultural years and a whole series of crop failures. And in, I think it was in the 1340s, when the first wave of the Black Plague hit Europe. Once that bad Black Plague swept across Europe and decimated, in some cases, you know, overall, over Europe, I mean, maybe up to a third of the population was wiped out. In other places, whole villages were basically decimated. So when that happened, that coincided with the end of the cathedral building era. And this began the transition from operative masonry into philosophical masonry.
So one major implication, Randall, is that because of all the dying, when civilization got its act together, when Europe kind of returned to semi-normalcy and economy was better and people had more surpluses and all that, I would imagine there were huge numbers of people, craftsmen, masons, experts, architects, engineers, who had died. So there was no way to restart the program, even if there had been a call to restart the program.
Yes, yes, exactly. I think that really comes very close to describing what happened.
And, wow.
And so you have during this period...
So again, what would have happened if we hadn't had that interregnum? What would they have continued to do? Would they have used more secret information and pressed on materials and created even more amazing cathedrals than the ones we've got?
I can't see why they couldn't have, because, I mean, there is actually an evolution when you begin to look at it. I mean, they did learn things, certainly.
Tell us about that, by all means.
Well, I mean, you see that the vaults are getting higher. They're getting wider through the course of the century after that first cathedral St. Denis. And... you see that, yeah, I mean, we need Skype here so we could have images to be looking at. But, you know, the glass, the ratio of structure, the ratio of glass area to structure increased so that they had, you know, greater spans with bigger stained glass windows. See, so was able to bring in more light, which is one of the whole functions of the symbolism of the cathedral, is bringing in the light from outside.
Have you ever seen that big thing down in Southern California, the so-called Crystal Cathedral?
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, Google Crystal Cathedral. Robert Schuller, I think, was the pastor. He's passed away. But it's an astonishing 20th century effort to mimic in glass what the architects, the masons of the Middle Ages, did with the cathedrals. It's really an amazing piece of architecture there in Southern California. It's called the Crystal Cathedral.
I've heard of it, and I certainly remember Robert Schuller. You know, I I just remember him for whatever reason.
He was very good. That's why you remember him. He was very good. He really could deliver a message or a sermon. Okay, so how did this connect you now to a bigger search, which is how did we all kind of wind up here? Was there a precedent civilization before the ones that we all know about?
I would think that basically when we look at the trend line of civilization, it has to be described almost as a sine curve, where rather than a smooth, ascending exponential curve, which is most of the typical representations of the rise of modern history from, tens of thousands of years of barbarism and scientific illiteracy, and then, somewhere, we see a blip there during the rise of Mesopotamian civilization. We see a blip during Egyptian, but essentially it's almost usually depicted as an almost smooth curve. But
inclined maybe 45 degrees, and it's Victorian, and it's progress, and we go from primitive to incredible, and it's only one time. We do it only once.
I think, Richard, that the correct model, the correct trend line, is going to have to be depicted as a sawtooth.
Excellent. Hold it there. Let's tease them. Real history is not a linear line. It's a sawtooth. A sawtooth to wear. My guest this morning is Randall Carlson. We're discussing masonry, the origins of amazing architecture that came from the Middle East after the Crusades, erupted in Europe, spanned about 100 years, and left us with so many iconic cathedrals and messages. We're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and yes, we are all sailors of destiny. We'll be right back. We are back on the other side of midnight on this frosty morning in the Land of Enchantment. Randall, if all this organized knowledge was found by the Templars and put into the cathedrals, how does this open up a window into our ancient past just on this planet? This information, to build a cathedral, to assemble an army of craftsmen, to spend years getting ready, means somebody had to have a template, a blueprint, an idea. All the engineering problems either were worked out or it looked like they could be worked out given what they had found.
I think that your choice of words is excellent, a template. And I think that perhaps what we're seeing here is that there's a master template, a universal template, if you will, that has basically all of the sacred geometry in it. And this sacred geometry is the geometry of the solar system, it's the geometry of the galaxy, it's the geometry of life.
It's the geometry of the hyperdimensional torsion field physics, which in the model makes possible reality, all 3D existence. So what these guys were doing is nothing less, Randall, than encoding the symbols of existence.
Yes, the symbols of creation, the geometry, in the medieval models, God was represented as the great geometrician, employing these principles to create the universe. And there is a template, as you said. I think it has been handed down. I think we see it present at the very dawn, at the very beginning of recorded history. We're seeing it inherited from some unknown source that preceded recorded history that goes deep into prehistory. I think at this point, there is nothing woo-woo or nothing tin hat or nothing pseudoscientific about saying that. At this point, what we now know, there is no reason, no a priori reason why we are justified in rejecting that basic idea, that our history goes much further back, much deeper, is much more complex than anybody has really even imagined, except for a few handful of mavericks. You know who they are.
We can count ourselves on one hand, basically.
Well, I think our ranks are beginning
they
to
are growing. They're definitely growing, yes, yes. From that breakfast all those years ago, Randall, we are in much better shape this morning because an awful lot of people now, and of course people all over the world through this program and many other programs, are looking at alternatives. I mean, if you look at discovery, if you look at travel, most of the time in history too, most of the time they're dealing now with the idea that we are not the first. But that's an incredibly heretical idea. How did you pursue it? I want to get back to your personal search because I think people can relate to this if they see it through your eyes.
Well, it was, you know, a number of these parallel interests that begin to merge, essentially. And you know, when I was a kid growing up, lived in rural Minnesota, back then it was, you know, when you went out at night, you could see the sky. And one of my favorite toys, along with my ViewMaster, was my little planetarium that I could come in my room at night and turn that planetarium on and put all the stars up on the ceiling and sit there with my little guidebook, you know, and learn the stars and the constellations and then go outside at night and see them all right there. And so astronomy was just, you know, that whole, it was inevitable that I had an interest in astronomy, but also the other thing was geologically. I lived in a rather interesting area, which was just northwest of the Twin Cities, and it was right near the margin of what was called the superior lobe of the Great Laurentide Ice Sheet that mantled North America, you know, from roughly 25,000 years ago down to about 10,000 years ago. And Our property bordered a lake, one of these little post-glacial puddles, of which there are thousands and thousands spread across Minnesota and Wisconsin. So we lived on one, and right in the woods alongside the lake next to our property was a big glacial erratic. Now, maybe as I look back, maybe it wasn't as big as it would seem to me now, but it was a good 6 or 7 feet in diameter, sitting there by the side of the lake. And, you know, I would just sometimes sit on that big rock when I could wander off. You know, I'm 7 or 8 years old, and I would wander down, and I could sit on that rock. I had a cane pole. I could sit on that rock with my cane pole and fish, catch sunfish and bass and bullheads and these things, and sitting on this rock. And I just remember quite often wondering, what's this big rock doing here, you know? So one day my dad laid a book on me, and he showed me some pictures of, I think they were actually pictures of the Little Ice Age, but he showed me in this book and said, you know, that there was glaciers here, you know, whatever, thousands of years ago, and that's why this lake is here. And so, you know, then I just began to notice things and how at the edge of all the farmers' fields there were hedgerows, but the hedgerows were growing along all of these linear piles of these boulders that had been cleaned out of their fields by the farmers because they were boulders that had been dropped and left by the glaciers when they receded. So there was this living in Minnesota and having this landscape that had been created by these dynamic processes of glaciation and deglaciation just sort of imprinted itself on my consciousness. At one point, let's see, I guess it was in 1969. Yes, it was 1969. It was the summer of 1969. I had just gotten out of high school. I was 18 years old, and there was a rock concert on a bluff overlooking the Minnesota River Valley that is just south of Minneapolis. And every week or so for that summer, they would have these free concerts out there. Somebody had set up a stage on these bluffs, and they would have rock groups and stuff. So one day I was at one of these summertime concerts, and I just remember it was a really, really beautiful day, and it was a break or something in the music, and I wandered over away from the crowd and walked out maybe, you know, a quarter mile away or something to the edge of these bluffs. And I'm standing on these bluffs that are about 150 to 200 feet high. Down below me is the little ribbon, blue ribbon of the Minnesota River, and I look across, and I now know, having studied maps and stuff, that it was about 4 miles. I look across, and I can see another set of bluffs that match the bluffs I'm on. And I'm standing there looking at this small river below and seeing that there's the banks of the river and seeing this juxtaposition of small and large. And I had this impression, also probably facilitated by the particular condition of my consciousness at that moment. And we'll just leave that enough said for the moment. But in any case, I had this impression that...
Okay, Randall. Gotcha.
That this large channel was just like an oversized version of this little channel. And this was my first inkling of something that has become, has evolved into one of the basic working concepts of my whole model of reality, which is scale invariance. And it's something that you encounter throughout the geological realm. So whenever you look at a geological textbook or any image of geology, of a geological feature, you'll always see something in that picture for scale, right? It might be the typical thing as a rock pick. But if it's a larger scale, a person will be standing in that picture, because otherwise so many of the natural features are scale invariant. They're fractal. You know, mm-hmm. Am I looking at something here that's 10 feet across or something that's 1,000 feet across? You know, you can't tell. So this is scale invariance. And one of the pictures I have that we can look at shortly here has a beautiful example of scale invariance. It's an aerial photograph I took of the Snake River Valley that sort of parallels the thing that I saw that day in the summer of 1969.
Okay, so is it time to go to Radio with Pictures?
We could. We certainly could, yeah.
Okay, everybody all over the world, you know, typing with their thumbs on their little digital device, go to othersideofmidnight.com. That's our homepage. Go to the upper right-hand corner. Click on the little banner there, Radio with Pictures. That takes you to Randall's page tonight. And scroll down, and we've got a series of items from Randall linked 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. So we should click on number 1?
No, if everybody's got, there's 10 images there. The one that relates to what I'm talking about now would actually be number 7.
Oh, okay. So we'll skip down to 7. Oh, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Modern Snake River, average annual discharge, 60,000 cubic feet per second. Highest recorded historical flow. Oh, come on, Randall. 1,900,000 CFS. 195.
Cubic feet per second.
19 points, but 195,000 cubic feet per second. That's
right. Yeah, I had
look
to make that
look
connection.
At that.
There it is. Okay, there it is. You saw it. I didn't see that.
Okay, so what are we looking at and why?
Well, okay, so now you see the modern Snake River down there, and it's in its own little channel.
Yep, but it's
and
in the middle of something.
Every once in a rare while, pardon me?
I said it's in the middle of something much bigger.
It's in the middle of something much bigger, yes. Now, every few decades, the Snake River might have a major flood, such as the word says, the highest recorded historical peak flow, 195,000 cubic feet per second in 1974. During that flood, the Snake River would have overtopped its banks and spread out onto the floodplain, but it would have been very shallow over the floodplain, just probably a few feet deep at the most.
Randall, do you want to note another weird hyperdimensional coincidence?
Why not?
I have no idea if this means anything, but it just struck me. 195,000 cubic feet per second in this major flood in June 18th of 74, right? 1974.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What happens if you invert 1974? 1947. That's the inscribed angle of the tetrahedron inside the sphere that gives you the 195.
Oh, right.
Isn't that cute? Anyway, move on.
Cute, that wasn't exactly the word I had in mind, but I'll go with it. Okay, so then what we see is that there was a major flood. It's called the Bonneville Flood, with an estimated peak discharge of 40 million cubic feet per second.
Oh, my God.
So you compare that to the average annual discharge of the modern Snake, which is 56,900, and you can see that...
Okay, so let me stop you there. The current Snake River in this aerial photograph is the normal flow rates. The 40 million cubic feet per second, that's what caused the much bigger channel...
Yes, you got it. That's exactly it.
Excellent.
That bigger channel is a fossil. It's a relic feature that was created in a geological instant by a gigantic catastrophic flood that modified the landscape in a dramatic way and essentially has left it intact as a fossil feature for about 12 or 13,000 years.
Hmm. You know, this is going to sound very heretical, but I've often wondered, particularly after I went and visited an awful lot and I took Robin and we watched sunrise over and all that, you know, mm-hmm. the classic interpretation of how long the Grand Canyon took to form, right?
Yes.
I just have this eerie, nagging feeling that we're looking at something with the Grand Canyon a lot more like this in your image, in a sudden huge major event, than a long, slow erosion on the tablelands of upper Arizona.
Let's put it this way. The Colorado Plateau began to erode in all this amazing canyon cutting that you see on the Colorado Plateau did not begin until the plateau itself rose up above sea level. And you know that at the high, near the rim rock of Grand Canyon, you've got shallow marine water, you know, marine limestones.
Mm-hmm.
So the Colorado Plateau is actually very young, geologically speaking, probably not more than 10 or 12 million years old. I think that what you had was that the plateau rose up, has been rising up, and then at about 2.6 million years ago, you had a major global shift, a planetary shift. We went from the extended warmth, balmy warmth of the Pliocene into the Pleistocene. And what that shift involved was basically, and how that shift has left its imprint in the geological record, is that's when we begin to see this oscillating cycle of glacial and interglacial ages. And so for about 2.6 million years now, there have been probably several dozen oscillations back and forth between glacial and interglacial ages. When those transitions take place, the normal pace of geological change, environmental change, climatic change, is vastly and dramatically and exponentially accelerated. And what we now know, and I think this, I can say this with confidence, we know that a large part of the global landscape has actually been shaped by these catastrophic events. And these landscapes that were created by these catastrophic events in a geological instant are now being slowly modified by the more gradualistic processes of erosion and sedimentation and so forth. But those features that were created by these catastrophes are on such a vast scale that it's going to take a very, very long time for the gradualistic processes to eventually efface them, which they will if given enough time. But, you know, this thing that we're looking at here is an example, a beautiful example of where you see this ancient channel, which was from this great Bonneville flood that was actually the overflow of Lake Bonneville, which was this massive lake of which Great Salt Lake is but a little dried up remnant.
Yes. Okay, what other image should we be looking at now?
Well, let's see. We could go to, I clicked the wrong button there. I'll get back here in sync in a second. I got one thing I can say about Grand Canyon. I think the point about that you brought up, I think what we're seeing in Grand Canyon is a succession of catastrophic erosional episodes.
Mm, yes, yes, okay.
And if you look at Grand Canyon, you'll see that there is an inner chasm, which was probably the result of the last catastrophic flow that would have been really right around the same time as this Bonneville flood.
Are we talking at the very bottom, what they call the Vishnu Schist?
Yeah, that's at the very bottom, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the bottom of the canyon, exactly. And that would have most likely was still, I would say, well, whatever the inner canyon is, it's about 600 or 800 feet at least, I think. And I would venture that inner canyon was cut during the last glacial-interglacial transition, which would have taken place, you know, 12, 13, 14,000 years ago.
Particularly if there was an awful lot more water than there is now, which begs the question, where would that water have come from?
Well, it would have been the same water, essentially, that filled up the Basin and Range Province. You know, all of these desert floors in Nevada and western Utah were part of this vast complex of lakes that existed during the Ice Age. And what we see is that this, the largest of these lakes was Lake Bonneville, but all of these lakes, Pyramid Lake, interestingly, out there is a remnant of a of Lake Lahontan, which was the second of the largest of these big lakes that, that filled these what are now desert valleys. And somewhere right around the very end of the last Ice Age, many of these lakes suddenly filled up very rapidly. Lake Bonneville did this, filled up very rapidly, probably as much as 300 or 400 feet or more. The first, the lowest saddle within this large basin was on the northern rim, and the water rose up and it breached that saddle, rapidly cut through about 350 feet of soft sedimentary rock, and then it hit a granitic sill rock, mm-hmm. which was much, much harder than this sedimentary rock. And at that point, it stopped. But it took, the estimate is about 1 year for that whole mass, and it was really like an inland sea. That's what you have to picture, because if you were out in the middle of this lake in a boat, you wouldn't be able to see the shoreline. I mean, so it was a huge lake. It was about 900 to 1,000 feet deep. And if you're ever in Salt Lake City or north of there in the Wasatch Mountains, you can very clearly see two shorelines. And the uppermost shoreline was the highest lake level before it breached the sedimentary dam. Mm-hmm. And then it rapidly dropped down to about 350 feet, and then the lake level stabilized at this granite sill. And that produced a second shoreline. Now, over the next 10 or 12,000 years, whatever this climate regime was that created this lake and then suddenly filled it up to overflowing catastrophically, that process was done. It was spent. And over the next 10 or 12,000 years, the lake slowly evaporated away to create the Bonneville Salt Flats, which is where they test the high-performance engines, right, and Great Salt Lake, and basically 900 to 1,000-foot deep lake evaporated away.
Leaving
these desert floors, which were clearly not desert. In fact, the environmental studies have suggested that during the Ice Age, many of these areas actually had grasslands and forests growing around them, which are now deserts. But if we go to, let's go to the next image, image 8.
Going to image 8 in radio with pictures.
Now, what we see there is some of the sediment that was being carried in this 40 million cubic feet per second. I'm standing.
I was just going to say, is that you for scale?
That's me for scale, yes. That's exactly right. That's
now, everybody, I want you to envision this guy showing up at my breakfast table and putting a cigar box down on the white tablecloth in front of me like, okay, I dare you to open this.
Yeah, this guy here.
This guy. Go ahead.
That guy. So I'm standing down in the flood channel. And that's what you have to realize here now is that the flood came through, cut the channel, and the modern river is just occupying this ancient, gigantic fossil channel.
Okay.
I'm standing down in the floor of the channel, and you see one of the walls of the channel behind me there.
Wow.
About 500 feet up above my head. This channel was flowing brim full at the peak of the flood. And the sediment, you know, when you go out and you walk by any river or creek where, you know, there's gravel and you look down and you see all this rounded little river rock. Well, that's what we're seeing here. This is the river rock. This is the material that was being carried in the waters.
You mean the force of the flood, the 40 million cubic feet per second, is rolling along the bottom of this channel that is cutting through the bedrock, these little cobbles that are like three times your size, as if they were little tiny stones rolling on the bottom of a creek after a rainstorm.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes, that's exactly it. And the water, like I said, the water was flowing 400 feet deep plus. I mean, at the initial part of the flood, it was flowing up on the surface. As the flood, the channel, the floodwaters then became confined to this channel. But as it flowed, it basically carved out, excavated the bulk of what was of the channel that was there before the flood. There was probably a pre-flood and antediluvian snake river flowing, but it would have at that time been flowing up on what would have been the land surface up above the cliff edge, you see. Now it's confined to this massive channel that was cut by this 40 million cubic feet per second.
Okay, so in these images we're seeing basically in the bottom half of, you know, from 7, 8, 9, 10, we're seeing examples of this incredible flood cutting. When you have a lot of water rushing through a landscape, it can move mountains, literally.
Literally.
So where did this lead you?
Well, see, this came later. It was because we'll go back to the earlier conversation. You see, we talked about basically the history of civilization on this planet being sawtoothed. And one of the things that I really began to understand when I began to look into this geometry and the relationships, you know, you find that there are this recurring sequence of patterns, of numbers, of numerical relationships, and they're redundant. They're just prominent, very prominently displayed in these structures, you know, in the Vedic temples that we find throughout Indochina, for example. They encoded these numbers that we find in the temples in Central America. They have the same numbers. And, you know, what we find in the Egyptian temples, even in King Solomon's temple, which was it started out with a double square, which was a very, kind of misleadingly simple geometry. But, you know, it's the double square that leads us in, whose diagonal gives us the three components for deriving the golden section.
Ah.
But in any case, there's this geometry embedded in these structures. Well, one of the things I began to realize as I studied, for example, into the Incan architecture and found that there were parallels to the Vedic architecture, this obsession with time and codifying within the architectural alignments these cycles of time, the cycles of the moon, the cycles of the sun, the cycles of the seasons. Over and over again, we find it in the monumental earthwork structures of the Mississippi and Ohio valleys. We find it in the buildings built by the Chacoan people in the southwestern deserts of New Mexico and Arizona.
Not far from where I am tonight.
Where are you?
I'm just north of Albuquerque, a little tiny place called Placidas, and Chaco is about 70 miles as the crow flies northwest.
Well, I'm sure you visited it.
Many times,
yes. Well, all those kivas and all that layout there, it's all geometric. Even without being trained in geometry, you can look at it and see that it's geometric. Casa Rinconada is geometric, and it's also astronomic and encodes key astronomical alignments, which in a sense create a type of a cosmic calendar. Have you managed to get to or heard of Chimney Rock up in southern Colorado? Not far from where you're at. Be a good little outing for you, a day outing. You could drive up there. It's just east of Durango.
Okay.
And it's an amazing astronomical observatory that uses two large chimney-shaped rocks as a sighting aperture against the distant horizon. And by means of that, they were able to track the 18.6-year lunar cycle. They were able to track the equinoctial solstitial cycles of the sun. But my point is that when I got into learning about these numbers and that seemed to be represented and codified in all of these architectural examples, I discovered somewhere, and I think it was actually first perhaps reading the work of this Indian mystic named Sri Aurobindo, who you may have heard of. And there was also another one who was the teacher of Yogananda Paramahansa. You remember him, Autobiography of a Yogi?
Oh, yes. Paramahansa. He's the one that basically figured out that we have about a 24,000-year orbit around the... he didn't figure it out. He was translating ancient Vedic texts that our orbit around the galaxy is about 24,000 years, which is not bad because it's more like 10 times that, 240 million, no, 100 times that, 240 million years, but the numbers are the numbers. It's almost like the numbers of the code separated from what they actually mean.
Yes, because, see, as it turns out, the motion, the average motion of the processional point westward against the backdrop of the fixed signs of the zodiac is slightly more than 50 arc seconds per year. Well, if you just work out the simple math on that, you find out that at that rate, it takes just slightly less than the number that was redundantly encoded in so much of the ancient architecture, particularly the Vedic architecture, but was also found in the Sumerian king lists that was found, multiples of which gave us the tables of the Vedic ages, the Yugas and the Kalpas. And that was all based upon the processional cycle of 25,920 years.
The correlation. Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We got 1.5 hour left to go with my guest this morning, Randall Carlson. We're looking now in correlation with his obvious geological intrigue of major earth features cut by massive amounts of water, the channel scablands of eastern Washington being the obvious example we've been showing. Then you go into, well, what happens is the earth shifts under feet. What happens to civilizations on top of that planet, on top of the crust? Do they rise and fall in synchronization? We're going to ask that question of my guest next. When we come back on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back in our last half hour before the weekend on this morning edition of The Other Side of Midnight. Randall, if this planet is so unstable, is this basically your model, your theory as to why we've had successive epochs of high civilization, that every time we kind of climb up to a certain plateau, the planet slaps us down and we have to kind of start over?
Almost, yes. I think that basically what we're dealing with here is that that the tempo of civilization matches the tempo of planetary change almost precisely.
Oh, and really? Now that's intriguing.
Yes. But planetary change, I'm at this point just about convinced that most of these catastrophic episodes are being driven from outside the planet. We talked very earlier in the show about the possibility, you brought it up, mentioning that perhaps there was some kind of a cosmic event, a cosmic impact, perhaps a fragmenting comet or something similar that could have actually triggered the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
And then I elaborated upon that by talking about the decade-long climatic downturn.
Well, you know, Randall, I had another one of those interesting thoughts. Suppose the impact collision with a comet fragment. Okay, now follow me here. You have the Middle Ages. You have this amazing Roman epic. You've got abundance rolling across the land, greater economy, greater personal wealth. You have this surplus that then is used to build the cathedrals in that epic, and then you have this Dark Age period, which, if it was initiated by an impact of a comet fragment. Suppose the comet fragment was carrying microorganisms, bacteria or viruses from the exploded planet in the asteroid belt that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, as part of this larger solar system massive catastrophe that happened in our calculations millions of years ago, with lots of stuff orbiting around the sun, and occasionally it runs now into the Earth. But if it finds a kind of a petri dish environment on the Earth, in other words, is it possible that the plague came from the solar system, from remnants of an ancient planet no longer with us that transmitted its extinct microorganisms into an infectious death period for planet Earth in the Middle Ages?
Well, I wouldn't rule it out, Richard. I had not necessarily made the connection with the idea of a destroyed planet.
Well, remember there's also Fred Hoyle, and there is a brilliant astronomer named Chandra Wickrama-Singh.
Wickrama-Singh,
who was up there at Cardiff, University of Cardiff, and he and Hoyle looked at biology in the solar system, microbes and viruses and bacteria orbiting the sun that basically interact with the Earth and cause periodic viral infections. They've actually got a model. If you put this all together and you say that that this life from outside is impacting and changing the Earth as well as the geology of major impacts simultaneously, that would kind of satisfy an awful lot of questions, wouldn't it?
Yes, and you know, it could be that some of these processes work in tandem, so that
yes,
if you have if let's say that Earth has a close encounter with a comet, and you know, comets are in the process of disintegrating. Once they're in near Earth space, they're in the process of disintegrating. The Earth could have a lot of cosmic dust accreted to it, which basically weakens people, weakens their immune system because of malnutrition. And that, coupled with the fact that there have been possible exotic biological material introduced into the biosphere, absolutely. I'm familiar with the work of Fred Hoyle and with Rama Singh and their work, Diseases from Space. And,
yep.
And yes, I certainly think that that's
see, what they don't know, because I haven't had a chance to talk to Vikrama Singh yet, is that in our model where we have architectural evidence now all over the solar system of an ancient, incredibly advanced super-civilization epic that ended 65 million years ago with the destruction of an entire world. They blew up a planet. Somebody blew up a planet. And if you blow up a planet that has life on it, all that life is going to go into a kind of a quick deep freeze. It's like, you know, quick freezing, vacuum freezing, Chase and Sanborn coffee. And then that in stasis, life finds another petri dish, the Earth, and it then resumes living. You know, we have millions of examples of life that can be in suspended animation. You add water, like tardigrades or one of those little creatures, and bingo, they're back to life. So in this scenario, the plagues on Earth that Vikrama Singh and Hoyle have been monitoring that seem to be correlated with astronomical collisions from outer space of objects, asteroids or comets, could in fact be life transmitted to Earth from the ancient cultures and life that was on the planet that's now gone. But the memory lingers on because every once in a while we get reinfected by new guys that come in from outer space and take hold for a while.
Well, I'm certainly thinking that that's a possible scenario. That's a twist on it that I hadn't really considered, it could be from a previous civilization. I had not made that connection. But now that you've made that connection for me, I'm going to ponder that and see what it says to me.
Yeah, and the other possibility, Randall, is because comets, not all comets are created equal. Some comets, in fact, some comets that NASA and ESA have visited appear to not be natural objects, little Bergy bits. They appear to be ancient, eroded, incredibly mangled spaceships, space
really?
Habitats. Particularly 67P. If this model is correct, if something like 67P, 2 miles across, were to hit the Earth, or even a much smaller ship, you know, half a mile across, 1,000 feet across, like an ocean liner, it would carry in stasis, in suspended animation, in frozen stasis, all the microorganisms that the inhabitants of that habitat had to live with during their lifetimes, and that infusion of life into a new petri dish, the Earth, the benign environment, suddenly would maybe lead to a microbial invasion and potential diseases on the Earth like Vikrama Singh and Hoyle modeled.
Sort of a cosmic counterpart to the transmission of viral material from the Europeans to the Native Americans.
Exactly. Same model, but on a much bigger scale.
See, there we go. Scale and variance. Again.
Scale and variance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing to think about that, for sure. So how much time we got left?
It's about 40 of the hour, so we got a little less than 20 minutes.
20 minutes? Do we want to look at a few more of those pictures?
Oh, absolutely, yes, particularly in context.
Yeah, okay. So the first pictures we were looking at were from the Bonneville flood. And it would be interesting or valuable, I think, to try to place these events that we're talking about here within this larger framework that we're discussing. So the first images we looked at were of the aftermath of this Bonneville flood, which was the overflow of Lake Bonneville out of Utah. Now, this flood flowed into what is now the Snake River Valley, made its way up through Hell's Canyon, and was probably largely responsible for excavating Hell's Canyon to the depth that it now is, passed up and then eventually flowed into the Columbia River and out to the Pacific. Apparently, at the same time, there was another giant flood coming from the north. Now, when you're standing at the junction of the Snake River and the Columbia in southeastern Washington, the Snake River is flowing up from the south, out of Utah.
Right.
The Columbia River is flowing from the north, out of British Columbia. You see, out of British Columbia, Canada.
Okay.
The two rivers meet there. Okay.
Ah.
Now, around 13,000 years ago, these two giant floods met at that junction. You had the Bonneville flood, which, as we saw, was peaked out at about 40 million cubic feet per second, which was about 700 times the volume of the modern Snake at its average flow. Now, at the other hand, coming down the Columbia, you had 700 or 800 million cubic feet per second.
What?
Yes. So,
oh, my
you
God.
Had, yes. You had 20 times the volume of the Bonneville flood coming as meltwater across the Channel Scablands of southeastern Washington. And these two floods met in southern Washington and basically drowned half the state.
Wow. And this is because of the massive melting at the end of the Ice Age, right?
Exactly, Richard. See, that, and that's it. The massive melting, the melting that happened so rapidly that the glaciologists haven't really been able to come up with a coherent theory to explain the rapid melting. And in fact, in the early 70s, there was a consortium of geologists and glaciologists that got together to look at the radiocarbon dating of the deglaciation process. Because in the older pre-radiocarbon dating models, they were allowing 40 or 50,000 years for the entire deglacial sequence from... Basically, you've got an ice cap bigger than the one now covering the South Pole, covering North America, right?
And extending, and basically extending down to what, the middle of the continent?
Yeah, in east of the Mississippi, it its furthest extent was where the Ohio River now flows, which was, it's like the Ohio-Kentucky border.
Right, okay.
And immediately south of there, what is now Kentucky, was tundra. And then if you go to the western United States, it just crosses the 49th parallel by up to 200 miles or so. The margin of the ice sheet kind of undulates from there across the prairie states and then mantles the Rocky Mountains and then the Cascade Mountains and essentially actually went down onto the continental shelf that is now drowned under the waters of the Pacific.
So the southern part of the continental United States, CONUS, as the Air Force calls it, would have been basically clear, desert, tundra, whatever, permafrost. And above that, there would have been, 2-mile-high cliffs of ice and then ice
over
to the North Pole?
No, the ice would have actually tapered, so that the cliffs at the ice margin might have been, 500 to 1,000 feet, maybe.
Oh,
but over the central
puny,
part of the ice
puny
sheet,
little things. Have you ever seen a building 1,000 feet tall? It was called the World Trade Centers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But over the central ice dome, it may have been up to 2 miles.
Yeah, like over Antarctica now.
Oh, like over Antarctica now, but this is now over Canada. New York, where New York City now is, was buried under a minimum of 1,000 feet of ice. Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, the Twin Cities. Chicago, all of these were under the ice.
They still don't know. I'm talking now glaciologists and climatologists and people looking on global, climate modeling and all that. They really still don't know why we had ice ages and why
That's
we're in
I'm
the middle
at.
Of an ice age.
We don't know. I think, going back to Fred Hoyle and Chandra Rukwamasinghe, the work of Victor Klube and William Napier, the British neocatastrophists, Duncan Steele out of Australia, I think these guys are the closest to figuring it out. And I think what we're talking about here is a cosmic trigger, both for the onset of glaciation and for the processes that triggered the deglaciation. So roughly 26,000 years ago, when the last phase of the Great Ice Age began, we probably had an encounter with a disintegrating comet or some cosmic object that would have caused a rapid climatic downturn, probably the accretion of a very large amount of cosmic dust that would have increased the opacity of the atmosphere, reflecting maybe up to 70 to 90% of the solar radiation back into space. This is like all based on the work of these guys I just mentioned. You know, Fred Hoyle modeled this. I mean, even back in the 80s, he wrote a book where he basically, theorized that the ice ages were the terrestrial consequence to these changes in the cosmic environment. And that makes total sense to me because, like you just said, for 100, 150 years, the scientists have been trying to come up with an explanation, but always they're basically referring to terrestrial processes or using astronomical processes such as the Milankovitch cycles, which are so slow and operate over such long periods of time that there's no way they could explain the instantaneous glaciarization or the rapid disappearance of the ice over a period of just a few thousand years. And this is what they realized in the early 70s when they once had like two decades of radiocarbon dating at their disposal, was that the onset of the ice age and the termination of the ice age was at least an order of magnitude faster than anybody had even imagined. And what we're faced with now is that the melting took place so fast at the end of the last ice age that it's a mystery where did the thermal energy come from that was able to accelerate the melting so fast that you had meltwater flows coming off the ice sheet that were up to 700 to 800 million cubic feet per second. And if we look at these images, 1 through 6 right now, while we got time, we'll see one regional effect of some of these flows, which is called, it's part of a feature called Grand Coulee, from which Grand Coulee Dam is its name.
Okay, yep, so we should click on image 1?
Let's click on 1.
Okay.
And what we see there is a topographic map, beautiful topographic map of a gigantic cataract complex.
It also enlarges. If you click it again, you can get bigger.
Yeah. And if you click it big, you can really see it's got a lot of detail in it. And what you're looking at here is a gigantic erosional feature. If you look carefully, you'll see that there is a series of squares on the map. Each of these squares is 1 mile on its edge.
The grid.
So you can look on the grid, the grid.
Okay.
And if you look at there, you'll see that you can count up, this whole cataract feature is about 5 miles wide. It's called Dry Falls Cataract, and it is a fossil feature from one of these gigantic meltwater floods that issued off the southern margin of what is called the Cordilleran Ice Sheet that was over British Columbia, Canada, and reached all the way up to Alaska. And it was about perhaps 1 million cubic miles of ice that had swallowed up this mountainous region. And it began to very rapidly melt between about 13 and 14,000 years ago.
A million cubic miles of ice?
Yes, about 1 million cubic miles of ice.
What happens when you melt 1 million cubic miles of ice? You get cubic miles of water.
Of water. And what does that water do when it crosses the landscape? Well, this is what we're looking at, like I said.
It tears it apart.
It tears it apart, rips it apart, just washes whatever was there is gone. And you can see the aftermath of one of these flows. Now, the flow that created this feature was about 400 million cubic feet per second.
Hmm.
Now, so that makes it about 10 times the size of the flow that we were just looking at for the Bonneville flood.
All right.
If we click now to number 2.
Okay, go back to radio with pictures, click on number 2.
Yeah, back to the pictures and then click on number 2. What we'll see is a Google Earth image of that same complex that we just saw, the topographic, that 1 to 24,000 topographic map. And inset up in the upper left corner, you will see Niagara Falls, both American Falls and Horseshoe Falls, inserted at the same scale.
Okay.
So
if you click on the image, if you click on the image twice, it makes it as big as possible.
Yes, and then you can clearly see the inset image up in the upper left-hand corner. So you can get an idea that if any of the listeners have visited Niagara Falls, you know, you're going to know that it's a pretty impressive
feature. I can see Horseshoe Falls, the American Falls. We got locked out of our car at the Horseshoe Falls. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
Okay. Well, obviously of significance for some reason.
Our family was definitely not happy, yes. We were very unhappy campers for a little while. Anyway, so Dry Falls Lake is about the same size, same scale as Niagara Falls.
Well, what you have to, these are at the same scale, but what you'll see here is that, like, if you look at Horseshoe Falls, it's just diminutive next to this, look at this entire...
The entire landscape, yes, the entire eroded, blasted landscape.
Right. The Niagara River, in Horseshoe Falls would be just literally swallowed up in this flow. Like I said, about 400 million cubic feet per second. And this created a chasm. I actually sent you more pictures than we've got posted there. So if you want to look at those, we could perhaps save those for another conversation sometime in the future.
Okay.
Because I sent you, I know probably 24 images, of which I think 10 of them are up there. But you can really begin to get a sense of the scale of this thing and what the force of this water will do to the landscape. What we're looking at here is just bedrock that has been completely stripped of all topsoil and then deeply etched by the force and violence of this 400 million cubic feet per second that's sweeping over the land. Let's go back to the thumbnails and click on number 3.
Okay.
And this is one of the alcoves.
Holy cow, Randall. I'm looking at your comparison.
Yeah, you're seeing the little inset in the upper left-hand corner.
That's the Horseshoe Falls, right?
That's Horseshoe Falls, right.
In the same scale as this huge embedded landscape that was ripped apart by 400 million cubic feet per second?
Exactly. That's it. Now, what you got a picture here, these cliffs of this large abandoned cataract are right at 400 feet high. The water coming over the rim here was about 400 feet deep. So at the peak of this flood, you wouldn't have even seen a waterfall. You would have seen a bump in this massive 5 to 7 mile wide, 400 foot deep river moving along at 60 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
And as it's moving, you've got to picture the force and violence, the sheer forces created by this water sweeping over the landscape is literally ripping the bedrock out, boulder by boulder, and sweeping these rocks down current, basically in this case, from this feature here, the depositional basin is about 25 miles south of here. And I actually have an image of what the landscape looks like when you exit the mouth of Lower Grand Coulee, because what we see here is basically a huge meltwater river that ran temporarily of this ice sheet undergoing this catastrophic meltdown. Then at this point, I think the explanation for this, there is a standard geological explanation for this, which in my opinion is quite lame and doesn't hold up, doesn't make sense, which would probably be beyond a discussion of that, would probably be beyond the time we have left.
We have 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Three minutes.
So we better go back and go to image number 4. Image number 3 is taken from about 2,000 feet up in 2,500 feet.
Here's our comparison again.
And then we're on image 4. This is from the ground level, looking into the westernmost alcove, which is only a small part of the entire complex.
Now, that little inset, that's Niagara Falls to scale.
Yes.
Look at the size of those cliffs, those barren, dry, parched cliffs now that once had 400 million cubic feet of water rushing over them per second.
Yes.
Amazing. Okay, in the last 2 minutes, big picture, what is this all telling us?
Well, these are just a few examples of which literally I have 10,000 images that I've taken of various features, which basically show a pattern, a tempo of global catastrophic change. And part of this information of dealing with these cyclical changes, and they are cyclical, is what's encoded and embedded into these ancient symbolical traditions. So this is really where the connection comes in. You know, these ancient temples, whether they're cathedrals or whether they're, temples in Indochina or in Central America, they are temples to the processes of time, temporal change. And basically, I think what they're doing is encoding the information, the specific information that leads us to understanding the tempo of these global changes that have essentially, in an instant, undone thousands of years of gradualistic change, caused a vast, very profound change in the whole environmental orientation of the planet. And when these events happen, as they have been happening fairly regularly, every 10 or 12 or 13,000 years, as far back as we've now assembled the record, a couple hundred thousand years, the time that modern humans have been around, what we've seen is that in the time that we modern humans have been on this planet for, you know, at least a couple hundred thousand years now, we're seeing a succession of these profound and dramatic changes that have swept over the planet and have created phenomena unlike anything we have seen in our modern historical times. And in fact, the inference here is that our modern history is what has arisen within the window between the succession of catastrophes. And that when we look back into the deep history of our species on this planet, we realize that we have been privy and we have been a party to these great sweeping changes that have affected this planet, and undoubtedly the civilizations that we have been trying to build on the surface of this planet.
Amazing.
And ultimately, I think what it's got to lead us to is that in order to break this cycle of catastrophes and become free of it, we must move towards becoming a cosmic civilization.
Perfect way to end. Randall, perfect way to end. Our music has started. I really want to thank you this morning for being my guest. Obviously, this is just part one of a very long and complicated story, because I have a different view as to why these catastrophes occur. I have a different view as to why they may be synchronized with the so-called Great Year. And we'll get into all of that the next time we meet on the other side of midnight. Until next week, then, Tuesday, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Have a great weekend, everyone. Good night.